Good morning. It is very good to be here with you, to see some familiar faces and some that I am not familiar with yet. Thanks for having me. I had asked, like way back in December, I talked to Frank one day and said, hey, I would like to preach there kind of as I wrap up Carmel. And I thought that would be like March, but it's June. You guys are way more organized than any church I've ever been connected with. I would never plan that far ahead. But I am really grateful to be here, and I kind of wanted to speak here just as I end my time at Mount Carmel, again, just to acknowledge this long history that Bethel Church as a congregation and certainly this building has had with Mount Carmel. It's an intriguing and interesting kind of history that it was in this building that, and from this congregation, really, that Mount Carmel started more than 50 years ago. I've got to put the last 25 years of my life into that ministry, but it still is rooted in a group of people who had a dream, who bought into an idea that really was kind of weird and was kind of odd, that people would think, well, we will start a Bible school and that will help others, but it really won't give much back to us as a congregation. But that's the kind of attitude that the kingdom of God calls us to do what's good for others. So Mount Carmel did start here in 1968, and many of you won't be aware of this. Mount Carmel is a one-year discipleship school now on the east side of Edmonton, but it started in this building in 1968. It moved to its current location in 1973, but really for the first 20 plus years of its ministry, it was anchored in this congregation by the people involved, the board members, the prayer support, and much of the financial support in a disproportionate way. It came from here, and this was the place that it worked from. And so I'm just really grateful and want to express appreciation for that. You have had a significant part to play in Mount Carmel and in that ministry. Mount Carmel is a place that helps young adults find their footing. Mount Carmel is a place that wants to help people find their faith footing. So many of our students come right out of high school and come uncertain of their future, but really they're also uncertain of their faith. They believe. They've grown up for the most part around church, but they don't know, what do I do with this thing? I have these ideas of belief, but I don't know what I do with them in life. And Mount Carmel kind of helps, intends to help people find how to put that into practice. Because it's messy. I don't always know. How do I react as a follower of Jesus in different and varied situations? And especially as a young adult, I don't always know, what do I do with this? I have these ideas, but then I don't know how to live them out. And that continues to be a huge struggle in the culture we live in, where people who have grown up around Christian faith are uncertain about now what? What do I do? There's a study that's recently been done across Canada now called Renegotiating Faith, which has looked at how do young adults transfer faith that they've grown up in the midst of and been given in many ways by their parents into their real lives. And Renegotiating Faith is the product of a 3 or 4 year study. And essentially it says people are not making their faith their own. And so then when they step into adult life, that they let go of the place they grew up in, the bedroom they had. They let go of their parents' practices of take your shoes off at the door, or, you know, whatever. But they also let go of faith because it's something that was given to them, and then it just fades away. And it's just almost a marker of independence to step away from faith. And so Renegotiating Faith, the study, comes to the conclusion that one of the things that can help people with this moving faith into their adult lives is what they call gap year programs.
In a gap year, the phrase comes from the British system, where people finish their high school late in the school year and start university quite, when they finish their high school, the university starts quite soon, and so often students will take a gap year, a year off between. What Renegotiating Faith is suggesting is that in the Christian church in North America, we need more gap years. Well, Mount Carmel was started here 50 years ago, and that's sort of exactly what we do. So we're working to help people transfer faith into life. But there's certainly challenges. I'm ending my time as president there and ending my active involvement. I am still very committed to the idea, but I really came to the conclusion that we just need new ideas and we need a fresh perspective. That always happens in organizations. And so as I step away, Ken Marshman has stepped in. But Mount Carmel continues to try to find ways to help faith connect to life. Some of our challenges are certainly recruitment. It's just really hard for us to let people know we exist. I know that Facebook exists and the internet exists, but you know what? There's billions of things on there. And we really have struggled to be able to communicate, to get face to face with people and say, here's what we do. We really do work hard at it, but we've found it very, very difficult. And so we're 4 out of the last 5 years, we've been less than 20 students, and we need to be at 20 in terms of just to be sort of self-sustaining. So recruitment is for sure an issue. It's hard to be known. I think one of the other challenges is broadening our base of support. We have a really strong base of support. I talked to other college leadership in the province, and they're always surprised and impressed with the amount of donations that we receive, because we really are dependent on donations. But our support base, our circle, is quite small. We draw students from lots of churches, but our circle of financial support still is quite small, and broadening that is a challenge and something we need to continue to work on. But we are really grateful for the support of people like yourselves, your congregation, and others that have been very supportive. So those are the challenges. But Mount Carmel's always had challenges. I started serving as president in 2003. And that summer I was in Mount Carmel working one evening, and Stan King Sr., who was working here for many years, used to come in and do photocopying there. So John's dad would come in, and he came in one day and we were talking. And he said to me, you know, when we started Mount Carmel, we thought there was 3 things we needed. We needed some staff, we needed some students, and we needed some money. If we had 1 out of the 3, we figured that was good enough. And that's sort of how it's always operated. It's sort of always been this little bit loose and a little bit weird. You know, what other churches do you know that had somebody in them who said, well, let's start a Bible college, and then did it, and then kept it going? And Mount Carmel's been a little bit unusual that way. It's a little bit messy. It's never quite as neat as you want to be. We always want things neat and orderly. We always want plans and structures, and yet so often God just doesn't work in that. God just works in the mess of our lives. Sometimes I think we start to act as if God always works when things are neat and orderly, and certainly part of what God wants to do in our lives is clean up our mess, transform us, change us, but he's always working with our mess. And we can start to act like, okay, we have to get everything in order and structured. So we chase holiness, and we should. And we chase obedience, and we should. But sometimes we forget that even though we are called to obedience and we're called to holiness, God starts with where we're at. And that's usually messy and weird. And that's where he starts to work. I've watched lots of mess over the years. I've watched lots of lives who maybe aren't near as structured and aren't as well thought through as they should be, start to be changed. We've had the mess of lots of different opinions. You get a board of people running a school. Those people represent 6 or 7 different churches. And you know what? There's tension and there's mess. You get people in a classroom coming from different backgrounds, and they have different ideas of what it means to live as a follower of Jesus, and it's a bit messy. And then you get students with different issues who start to be honest about what they're struggling with. And it's never as organized as you want. And that's when God shows up. Because God's always showing up in mess. God has always specialized in stepping into mess. Sometimes I think we clean up the stories in the Old Testament particularly too much. But I think the New Testament too, that we become so used to them that we think, oh, well, that was just this nice, smooth transition. But when you look at some of those stories, they are messy. Last fall, I was in downtown Vancouver with students. We take all of our students to Vancouver, do a lot of things on the downtown east side, which is often referred to as the poorest postal code in Canada. One of the things we do is we have our students walk, spend 6 hours just walking, 5 or 6 hours, and they're looking for certain things. We're trying to get them exposed to these people who are often very disadvantaged. So while they're doing that, I'm just walking around watching them. And as I started talking to a group of our students at one point, and I was telling them that if they went down to this corridor and went that way, they would find places to eat quite cheap because they're on a pretty limited spending budget that day. And as I told them, a man walked by me and said, oh yeah, but if you go further, there's even a better deal. And so he and I started conversing. And we were just having a little chat. And then he said to me, well, I have stage 4 colon cancer. And I looked at him and I said, oh, I am sorry. And he looked at me and he said, are you really? If you could, would you take my cancer into your body so I wouldn't have it? And all of a sudden it got a little messy. All of a sudden it was like, okay, I know the technical answer. I'm supposed to say yes. I'm supposed to say that's what Jesus did. I'm supposed to say, but that's not really true. Would I take stage 4 cancer into my body? And so I stood and I looked at him, and I have 3 or 4 students standing beside me waiting to see, what am I going to do? And I don't actually know exactly what I said, but something to the effect of, that is a really good question. And I can't take your cancer, but I sure appreciate you thinking about that. And he and I had another 3 or 4 minute conversation that wasn't confrontational, but it was messy. And I left with all sorts of things in my head, like, I don't know what I did. But that's where God shows up. God shows up in the mess. One of the other trips that Mount Carmel has done over the last 15 or more years is take students to First Nations communities in the north. Probably 12 or 14 years ago, a little sticker showed up on the wall in the office of one of Mount Carmel's staff. And all that sticker said was, remember Murphy. Because Murphy was a student, a grade 4 or 5 student in one of the schools in one of those communities in northern Alberta. And Murphy showed great interest in faith, great openness to people, and a great need to connect with someone outside of his community. And so for a long time, on the wall of an office in Mount Carmel was this little post-it note that just said, remember Murphy. And we remembered Murphy, and we would see Murphy every year when we took students to that community. And Murphy would come to the house that our students would be staying in any particular year. He would find where we were. And Murphy was with us for that week. And then we'd go away, and Murphy would stay in his community. And we prayed for Murphy, and we talked to Murphy, and we connected with Murphy over Facebook, and Murphy would send messages. And then 2 days after the high-level area was evacuated this spring, I got a phone call telling me that Murphy had died. Murphy's about 25, and I don't know where his faith was at. I don't know any of that, but it's messy. And I want faith, and I want growth, and I want Christianity to be this neat linear line, and I want Mount Carmel to be this neat thing, but God always shows up in mess. I want to take you to the story of Jacob. Jacob and Esau, sons of Isaac. Jacob, the guy who becomes the forefather of the nation of Israel. Jacob, the guy who doesn't start life that well. And I'm going to more tell the story than walk you through the story, but you're going to find the bits at the end of Genesis 25, and then in 27 to 29. You can glance through it, but Jacob really is a bit of a mess. Jacob's born along with his twin brother Esau to his parents, Isaac and Rebekah, in their middle ages. One of the first things we're told about him is that he tricked his brother. that as they grew and became adults, his brother was a hunter and he was a homebody. And on a particular day, his brother was particularly unsuccessful at hunting, was particularly hungry, and Jacob took advantage of his brother. See, his name means deceiver, or maybe trickster. And it was in his DNA, for lack of a better term, that's probably not technically true, but it was within his person to just trick. And so Jacob tricks. Jacob takes advantage of his brother for his own benefit, gets his brother to sell off his birthright, the privilege of the older child to inherit the bulk of the family wealth. He makes a deal with his brother in his brother's moment of need, takes advantage of Esau, and he gets the family inheritance. Nice guy. He's looking out for number one. This becomes sort of what Jacob does. And then, years later, as his father seems to be facing a health crisis and imminent death, Jacob takes round number two out of his brother Esau. Along with the help of Jacob's mother, Rebekah, he tricks his father this time, and he steals the blessing. So he's taken the financial benefit from his brother. Now he takes the words of power and the words of blessing and the spiritual heritage from his father, and he dresses up like his brother, gets his mom to make the meal, like he's still a little bit of a mama's boy. He goes to his dad pretending to be his brother with wearing fake hair, goat hair, goat skin. I mean, he's going so far as to put on a costume. And his blind father feels the goat skin and says, "Oh yeah, that's my son." Like, how hairy is Esau, which is whose name actually means hairy, right? And all these things, and Jacob not only has taken the financial benefit, now he takes the spiritual heritage from his brother. And this is like the son of the promise. Isaac was the promised one to Abraham, and now his sons are playing this game of tricking and stealing and deceiving. And this doesn't look good. This is not how God's people are supposed to act. And yet God's in the midst of the mess. Well, after Jacob steals the blessing, after he does what he has to do to get ahead, he's looking out for number one, he finds out that comes with a cost. Comes with the cost of being hated by others, particularly his brother Esau, and now his life is in danger, and Esau is plotting to kill him, and he has to run, and on his mother's advice, he runs to his uncle Laban, who lives 1,000, 1,200 kilometers away. It's where his mother came from, and he's running. And he takes off from home, and God steps into his mess. God shows up in the form of a dream. We're not big dreamers in this culture. We don't pay much attention to our dreams. But man, in much of the world, dreams carry a lot of power. And certainly in Jacob's world, they did. And so when he dreams, it's not just his mind. The way we would rationalize dreams is your mind is sorting through all these things. No, no. It's God speaking. And he dreams that there's a connection between heaven and earth. And God steps into Jacob's lying, cheating, deceiving life. And he wakes up knowing that he has encountered God. God has not abandoned him. God has not said, "You are not good enough." In fact, right in the midst of Jacob running away to avoid the consequences of his deceit, God shows up and steps into the mess and says, "I am here." In his dream, Jacob sees angels moving between heaven and earth. And he realizes God has not abandoned him. But Jacob has spent his life looking out for number one. And so in looking out for number one, he wakes up from this dream. And rather than submitting to this God who has stepped into his dream, he makes a deal. Because Jacob's always making a deal. Because Jacob's always looking out for number one. And so he says to God, essentially, "Let's make a deal." And he says to him in Genesis 28, verses 20 to 22. He says, "If you will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I am taking and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear so that I return safely to my father's household, then the Lord will be my God. And this stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give you a tenth." Here's Jacob running for his life. God shows up, says, "I'm here." Jacob goes, "Okay, like if you come through, then I'll let you be my God. You can have the privilege of being my God." if everything goes good for me. How often do I do that? That actually, I think, I wanted to rationalize in my head that I am responding to God and I am being obedient and I am being submissive, and then I'm making deals. I'm like the guy drowning, you know, and every breath come up, shoots a prayer. If you just save me, if you just save me, and then somebody saves him and the prayer is gone, he forgets. And how often are we in the midst of our mess? But how often are we in the midst of our mess? That's actually hard to say. Just shooting out prayers to God and really making deals. And he puts conditions on God. Because we too are a mess. I do that. I use God for my own advantage. Well, Jacob goes to his uncle Laban, and this is through chapter 28, 29. Goes to his uncle Laban, gets tricked. Oh, you know what? He's a deceiver. And he's a trickster. And then he meets his match. Uncle Laban's better at it than him. Jacob's mom learned it from her family. Uncle Laban's been in the family. He knows how to do this. You can marry my daughter, 7 years work. Oh, guess what? Wrong girl. You can give me another 7 years. And all of a sudden, Jacob meets his match. But then he starts to find the rhythm. And he finds ways to get livestock from his uncle Laban. Has that weird water trough trick, which is bizarre. But he starts to gain wealth. 20 years later, 20 years after that dream, where he said, I'll make you a deal, Jacob heads for home. He has to run. Uncle Laban's sons, Uncle Laban's workers are getting frustrated with him because he keeps winning. And he runs. And as he goes home, he starts thinking, you know, my brother Esau is still there. This is not going to go that well. And he sends some emissaries ahead, and they find out that Esau's not that mad, but Esau's coming, and Jacob's worried about this, like, how is this going to go? And he starts dividing his camp up so one of the half of them will survive. And then he reaches a river, and it's kind of the borderline. And when I cross this river, I'm going to be on Esau's side of the protection. Divides his animals up. And by this point, he sent some gifts ahead so that Esau will meet successive herds that will all be offered as gifts. And this will soften Esau's heart. But he's kind of done all he can do. And then God shows up. 20 years ago, Jacob made a deal. And now God comes to call him to it. See, God hasn't given up on Jacob. Jacob's still a trickster. He's still trying to buy off his brother. He's still doing all these things that are just in his nature. And how long does it take me to change from the things that are in my nature? But God shows up in the mess. And in Genesis 32, the end, there's this weird little story. The night before Jacob crosses the river. That night, Genesis 32, verse 22. Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions. So Jacob was left alone. Can you imagine? I've been away 20 years. And he's left alone and he's thinking, and you would assume he's reflecting a little bit and he's worrying quite a bit and he's wondering. And a man wrestled with him till daybreak. What? Like, where does this come from? And what is this? And this is weird and this is messy. But some person shows up on the riverbank and they have them a wrestling match. But God hasn't quit on Jacob. God hasn't walked away from him. And he comes to say, so, you've sent all these herds. I've provided you food to eat, clothes to wear, a family, wealth. Am I your God? And Jacob wrestles. Because these are messy things. I'm never that clear and black and white of, oh yeah, that's enough. I'm good. You're my God. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, let me go, for it is daybreak. But Jacob replied, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Jacob's already been blessed. That's the point. The man said, what is your name? Jacob, he answered. Then the man said, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel. Because you have struggled with God and with human beings and have overcome. And if you look at the note at the bottom of at least some Bibles, it'll say something like, Israel probably means he struggles with God. And it's kind of interesting that our spiritual forefather, his name is changed to he struggles with God. We are the children of struggles with God. We are the children of Israel, the descendants of Abraham, but we're in that spiritual lineage. Struggles with God, it's messy. It's never clean, it's never neat. But God shows up in the midst of mess. And so Jacob faces this wrestling match in the middle of the night. God marks him with a limp. And every step he takes, maybe from that day for the rest of his life, we're not really told. Every step he takes reminds him that he struggles with God and loses. He limps. Next story. Immediately after he goes, he meets his brother Esau, all good. Esau says, hey, well, I'll send some men with you till you get to my place, you know, and we'll take, oh, no. Jacob says, Israel says, it's okay, we don't need your help. His brother leaves. He immediately does a hard right, turns, goes somewhere else, and doesn't go to his brother's house. After he said, it's still in him. He's still messy. It's still this weird story. But that's one of our spiritual forefathers. Because life is messy. And as I work with students and encounter all their mess, I have been constantly reminded that I'm not far from it myself. And spirituality is not just about obedience and holiness. That's where we're going. But it's also about God showing up in the midst of our mess, in the midst of our uncertainty and our disobedience and our struggle, that God still steps in and loves us and cares for us and works to change us. And we're not done. And some of us have been following Jesus a long time, and we're not done. And it's okay, because God comes to those who struggle. And God makes the most of the mess. And Jesus lived that way too. Jesus showed up in town, and this dude named Zacchaeus, who nobody liked and nobody cared about, and nobody wanted to be around, has some interest. Everybody excludes Zacchaeus because of his role in society as a tax collector. People willingly stand in front of him to block his view. They don't care. Zacchaeus climbs a tree, wants to see Jesus. And it's to messy Zacchaeus, the guy who works for the occupying force, who is making his living by collecting taxes for the Romans. It's to him that Jesus says, hey, I'm going to come to your house today. What are you doing? You don't go to his house. But Jesus does. Because God always steps into mess. God steps into the uncertain and the unliked. Jesus has a woman at his feet, pouring perfume on his feet. And the Pharisees, the guys who know how to do it right, are saying, what are you doing? Don't you know who she is? Don't you know what she's done? But God always steps into the mess. And we want to step away from the mess as fast as we can. And I want you not to see my mess, and I want to put on a good front. But God welcomes the mess and welcomes the uncertainty and then takes that and changes it. And so some of us live with mess in our lives. Some of us live with uncertainty, and we would do well to remind ourselves that struggling with God is part of our spiritual heritage. We would do well to remember that it's in the midst of the mess that God comes to us and calls us to something more and moves us to something more and calls us to obedience and to holiness. But he starts where we're at. And sometimes we become convinced that we have to be a little bit more together. And I, maybe more than most people, have had the privilege over many years to work with students who just aren't able to hold it together and to be reminded that it's in mess that God shows up. It's in the weirdness that God shows up. And our call as followers of Jesus is to step into the mess of lives and to step in with grace and communicate God's goodness. And we get messy. We get pulled into things that aren't near as neat as we want them to be. And of course, churches are going to be messy too, because we're all people that are working through our own stuff. But that's what God does in life. He steps into our mess and says, let's start a process. And we're invited to be people who continue to struggle with God, who continue to wrestle through our things, and to say, I will let you be my God. And so we find ways to work with people. I notice you're starting into 1 Thessalonians, and there's a verse that's marked a lot of my thinking over the last several years in 1 Thessalonians 5 that just reminds me that this is messy, and people always are. 1 Thessalonians 5:14. And we urge you, brothers and sisters, warn those who are idle and disruptive. Encourage the disheartened. help the weak, be patient with everyone. What do we do when life is messy? Well, sometimes we warn people. Sometimes we encourage the disheartened. We help the weak. But who knows what somebody really is? Is that person weak or are they just lazy? Is that person weak or are they being disruptive? How do I know? Be patient with everyone. And we step into mess and we step into the uncertainty of life, knowing that God is there and knowing that this is our spiritual heritage. And God steps in. He steps into life as it is and invites us to let him continue to work with us. And the Jacob story reminds us that God isn't scared of our mess. God isn't scared of your individual mess. He's not scared of the mess that happens in a church like this. He's not offended by it, but we're called to bring God into the mess and to find ways to let God work in the midst of that. It's always been the call of Mount Carmel. That's always been the call of followers of Jesus. I think I was supposed to talk about what I'm doing. I don't know. My life's a mess. I have no idea. I really don't. I have a lawn care company that I've had for lots of years. That's always been sort of a summer thing. I have somebody that does the bulk of the work for that. She will continue, but I may step more into that through next year. For the next year, I intend to just get a job. I will need some income, but I will get a job. And then about a year from now or next spring, I'll start thinking, okay, like what do I want to do for the next phase? But I'm just going to build a buffer in here, get a job that doesn't require very much thought, life. And then we'll figure out from there what we're doing. Let me pray. Father, I am grateful that you take us as we are in the midst of mess, that you step in just as it is. And so again, we invite you to step into our lives just as they are, with our questions about kids, our struggles about finances, our uncertainty about our own values. May you be our God today. And then help us to extend that grace to others. Help us to be patient with everyone, I pray. For your sake, amen. Amen.